You're tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Last week I did a show on why we sleep, and this week I'm doing a show on why we dream. I'm going to start by quoting from an article by Alice Robb, who has written a book called Why We Dream. She has discovered that paying attention to dreams can help us understand ourselves. She says it's because dreams rarely make literal sense that it's easy to dismiss them rather than try to interpret them. But some recent scientific work, and I'm going to delve into that in this Sharon Hour tonight, has indicated that we probably should pay attention to them because they not only help us consolidate new memories while pruning out the stuff we don't need to remember, but they can be fantastic creative outlets, a breeding ground for ideas. As Alice Robb writes, a time for the brain to experiment in a wider network of associations than we have in our waking life, because they let us work through our anxieties in a low-risk environment, and by doing so provide practice for when those anxieties might actually manifest themselves in our real waking life. Science seeks to prove that our dreams aren't just biological accidents. Most things that happen to us on a continual basis are unlikely to be biological accidents after all, but most likely have root in some evolutionary plan. The Finnish neuroscientist Antti Revonsuo believes this, that our dreams are practice grounds for dealing with trauma. Otherwise, he posits, why would our own minds subject us to something so consistently unpleasant unless it was to help us in our evolutionary development? And why would even urban types with little or no experience of the wilderness often dream about being attacked by dangerous animals, animals from the wild, unless it dates back to our caveman days? Many of us have those nightmares where we're taking an exam that we're not properly prepared for, and some psychologists believe that in times of stress, we even dream about exams that we actually succeeded in, because our brains need to remind us of a time when we prevailed over something we'd feared in order to boost our confidence. Alice Robb said she herself had these kinds of exam nightmares, but it gave her a chance in the light of day to recognize how ridiculous they were. So when she's preparing for a meeting that she feels unprepared for, she can remember these dreams and it takes away their power to terrify her. She says no matter how unprepared she feels for the meeting that she's worried about, she knows she's not going to turn up to it naked. Don't you hate those dreams where you suddenly realize you don't have anything on from the waist down? That seems to be a metaphor for other kinds of exposure. In dreams. Dreams, by the way, is my topic on tonight's KX935's The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, currently quoting from a Times article by Alice Robb. She mentions a psychologist called Isabel Arnoff who discovered that amongst students studying for a test, the ones who dreamt more about the test performed better at it in real life. And more interestingly, the top five of her students had actually encountered some exam-related obstacle in their dreams, such as sleeping through their alarm or running out of time to complete the exam. So that would suggest that they did have some purpose, those nightmares, for confronting the worst so that you could then achieve the best in real life. But if they do serve that kind of function, why are our dreams often so incomprehensible? Alice Robb asks. Why do they traffic in garbled metaphors and disjointed images? In fact, most of our dreams are actually less bizarre than we might assume and do bear some relationship to what goes on in our waking life. A psychologist called Frederick Snyder did a test in which he found 38% of the settings in the dreams of the people he experimented with were real places that dreamers actually recognized from their lives, or certainly resembled those places. Only 5% were considered exotic, and less than 1% counted as fantastic. When Dr. Snyder scored each dream report on how coherent it was, i.e. whether the story made sense or the events could conceivably take place, he found that actually 9 out of 10 considered them credible descriptions of everyday experience. And even in the longest dreams, half of those dreams lacked a single bizarre element. Of course, this doesn't always happen. Maybe the dreamers he examined were more conscious dreamers, maybe lucid dreamers, and we'll get into that in a minute. Because occasionally, for those of us that maybe are less interested in our dreams, or even have less recall of them because we don't keep dream diaries, which a lot of people fascinated with dreams do, might find our dreams fantastic when we wake and do remember them. And at the turn of the century, three researchers, Robert Stigold, Alan Hobson, and Cynthia Rittenhouse, set out to study whether there were any constraints on the dreaming imagination. And they found there were, that there were actually rules and patterns at play, that dreams aren't governed by the normal laws of physics, for instance, and there are lots of other aspects of dreaming that are mysterious. We can't always strike up the image that we want or conjure up the person that we want into our dreams. On the other hand, they're not always the free-for-all we imagine them to be. They can be a little bit removed. For instance, a swimming pool can be a beach. An uncle can turn into a neighbor. A car can be a bike. But these researchers found that a dream object doesn't transform randomly into another object. It usually transforms into an object that shares some association with the real-life object or person. And in other studies, other researchers have found that the emotions in dreams are usually appropriate to the situation, even if the situation itself is odd. Something else that was surprising and constant, that the dreamer's own self was well-preserved and, quote, rarely plagued by features incongruous with waking reality. And thus the representation of self is presumed to be one of the most fundamental cornerstones of our long-term memory systems. In other words, even in dreams, we sense who we are. Maybe we do so more accurately than we do in waking life. Let's see if that's so in this interview that the Finnish neuroscientist Dr. Antti Revonsuo did with David Van Noys of the Shrink Wrap radio podcast. Introduced to you now on this, The Sharer Now, with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935.
I had a very interesting kind of a pre-lucid dream when I was about 15, or a false awakening as well. It was where I woke up in my own bed, and I was just like in a normal morning. I went to the kitchen, and my parents were there having their morning tea and reading the newspapers. And then some of the news just didn't make any sense. It was just some person was supposed to be the member of parliament, and I knew that that person is just some kind of different celebrity. And I commented on that, and then my parents looked at each other and said that, oh, he has gone crazy now. And then I started to really wonder, is this real? Don't I know anymore what is true and what is false? Or is this a dream? And I was looking out the window, and I was knocking at the kitchen table and everything, and this feels so real, that must be real, can't be a dream. And then I woke up in my own bed again, this time for real, but it made me really wonder, is this now real or is this still a dream? And that dream was something that I kept wondering about for many, many years, always wondering what was that place where I was, trying to find out, is it a dream or is it a reality? So that was, I think, one of the dreams that kept my curiosity aroused all the time, wanting to really find out what dreams are. When I was in senior high, I was already interested in psychology, but I was a little bit disappointed that we didn't hear that much about dreaming, because I was paying attention to my own dreams and always very curious about what are they really. I had some lucid dreams or pre-lucid dreams and some other weird dreams that I kept thinking about, and I was really very curious to find out more about them, and I was borrowing some books from the library. I even read Freud's interpretation of dreams when I was still in senior high school. Dreaming was one of my big motivations to go to the university to study psychology, although I didn't learn that much about dreaming during my studies there. So when I had graduated and I was wondering if I should go to research or to become a clinical psychologist, psychologist or neuropsychologist, and I started to get really interested in both consciousness and dreaming. But there was nobody at my university who had done any research on dreaming, so I just started as a kind of a hobby with some of my friends who were also studying psychology. And together we started to have a sort of a small dream group, and we all of us were writing down our dreams, and then we were discussing them, and we were trying to induce lucid dreams. I also was keeping a dream journal, and I started to think about, would it be really possible to really carry out some solid research into dreaming as well. So it started out as a kind of a hobby, and then it turned out to be one of the lines of my research. I kind of smuggled it in gradually into my PhD project. It's a difficult topic when you are dealing with scientists and people who want to do some hard science. After I got my first publication out from Dream Research, then it was kind of legitimate to carry on.
You're listening to The Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on Lunas KX 935. My topic tonight is why we dream, and I'm playing you an interview that a Finnish psychologist, Antti Revonsuo, did with psychologist David Van Noyes on his Shrink Wrap Radio podcast, in which he is asked about his threat simulation theory regarding dreaming.
It's quite a new idea. So not many people maybe have heard about it yet. I mean, I studied biology as a minor, and my father was a biologist, so I had a kind of a biological perspective in psychology. And then I was trying to define what kind of a phenomenon dreaming is, and I ended up with a sort of a definition that dreaming is like a biologically programmed virtual reality that gets activated every night for us. It simulates the perceptual world. Then this functional question came up, and I thought, but that must take a lot of effort and energy and organization from the brain to be able to do such a thing, because it's pretty complicated stuff to simulate, for example, the social world, other people that we see in our dreams going about their business. But the brain can't do it just somehow randomly, like many theories assume. But I thought that dreaming wouldn't be an organized, simulated world if it was the result of a random activation. So then I started to think, when we use simulators or virtual reality, what do we use it for? And the first thing that came to my mind was flight simulators. They have a very clear purpose, because you need to train pilots to handle emergency situations. And it's quite risky to do that with a real plane. So with a flight simulator, pilots can go through situations that happen very infrequently. And then they have already a pattern of responses fresh in their mind. And from that, I thought, well, if dreaming is also a simulation, maybe the brain is using it in the same way for us to go through very risky situations that would be too risky to practice and rehearse in the real life. But almost no risks and very little costs, only the kind of energy cost that it takes from the brain to keep up this kind of high-level activity that you can actually feel that you are in a real world. Also, unlike the pilots who are in the flight simulator, they know that they are in a flight simulator and it's not a real plane, even if it's kind of deceptively looking like the same. But when we dream, we have no idea that it is a dream. We take everything very seriously, unless we are lucid, and that happens very rarely and very difficult to keep lucidity up.
And we're going to get into that whole topic of lucid dreaming later in this show. You're listening to The Sharer Now on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James. My topic on tonight's show is dreams, and I'm currently playing you an interview Finnish psychologist Antti Revonsuo did with his colleague, the psychologist David Van Noyes, on the evolution of his interest in dreams, which ultimately led to his particular threat simulation theory on dreaming.
At that point, I actually wasn't that well aware of the literature on nightmares or post-traumatic dreams, or things like that. And then I started to just read the literature. And when I was reading about post-traumatic dreams, for example, Hartmann's articles and books, because he was writing a lot about post-traumatic nightmares. And I thought, wow, it's so fascinating, but it seems to work exactly as this kind of a theoretical idea would predict, that you encounter something very threatening. Your life is maybe threatened in the real world. And then after that, your dreams will start to make you go through similar situations every night until you have, in a way, rehearsed them sufficiently. And then after that, if nothing happens, maybe your post-traumatic dreams gradually become less frequent. But if you encounter a similar situation or something reminds you of that old traumatic situation, the nightmares come back immediately, as if that you are cued that maybe something similar is again about to happen, so you need to be prepared again. These sorts of things in the literature made me feel that, well, this could really be an idea that explains perhaps not all kinds of dreams, at least a very big portion of dreams, bad dreams, recurrent dreams in children and also in adults, because there are very similar themes that they go through. And then this connected my ideas to that, well, but maybe the origin is evolutionary, that life was so much more dangerous in human evolutionary history when we were living as hunter-gatherers. The environment was full of all sorts of dangers from nature, and it would have been a good idea to get prepared for those. And again, when I looked at what are the most universal themes in nightmares, the theme of being attacked, being chased by wild animals, by unknown bad guys and stuff like that. That sounded to me like, well, this seems to be something that must have been a major threatening situation during all of our evolutionary history. But it's not that commonly encountered by us who live in the safe Western societies. We don't need to run away from wild animals, or at least not very often.
Judy wrote the saddest song. She showed it to a boy in school today. Judy, where did you go wrong? He used to make me smile when I was down. Judy was a teenage rebel. She did it with a boy when she was young. She gave herself to books and learning. She gave herself to being number one. Judy, I don't know you if you're gonna show me everything. Judy, I don't know you if you're gonna show me everything. Judy got a book at school. She went under the covers with a torch. Fell asleep till the first morning. She dreamt about the girl who stole a horse. Judy never felt so good except when she was sleeping. Judy never felt so good except when she was sleeping, yeah. She wrote was Judy and the dream of horses, dream of horses, dream of horses, dream of horses. The best looking boys are taken, the best looking girls are staying inside. So Judy, where does that leave you? Walking the street from with the star upon your shoulder, lighting up the path that you walk. With the parrot on your shoulder, saying everything when you talk. If you're ever feeling blue, then write another song about your dream of horses. Write a song about your dream of horses. Call it Judy and the dream of horses. Call it Judy.
the images in dreams aren't always precise images. They're often metaphorical ones. Things that have disturbed us in life can play out in post-traumatic dreams. Dreams is the topic of my share now tonight here on KX935. Why we dream. Finnish psychologist Antti Revonsuo has a theory on this, as have other psychologists and psychoanalysts. Heinz Hartmann, for instance, who was a protege of Freud, suggested that we can often replay traumatic experiences in real life through post-traumatic dreams.
Hartmann was one of the first ones who really pointed it out, that there is a sort of a time window, usually a few months, during which the post-traumatic dreams gradually change, and the first ones immediately after the trauma, they are most similar to the original experience, but even those are not entirely identical. But then they become more diverse and they become connected with perhaps other threatening situations in one's life, perhaps some horror movie scenarios or something like that. They become more and more connected. And his idea was that the function of dreaming is more like emotion regulation function, that these very emotionally difficult experiences become connected in our memory networks and in emotion networks to lots of other experiences so that we can deal with them and they are not so horrifying anymore. They become just part of normal life, so to speak, and part of our normal memories. So he saw it as a kind of a calming down process, which is a quite different idea from what my idea was about what the function of dreaming is. But if this, whatever triggers the post-traumatic dreams, if it's a single event, some catastrophe where you are involved and then it's over, then we probably would see this kind of a pattern that the dreams are first very, very active, then they become less and less frequent, and they become also more diverging from the original theme and connecting it to different kinds of scenarios. And that would also make sense from the simulation point of view, because it's very unlikely that we encounter exactly the same situation in an exactly the identical manner. Rather, it's good to be prepared to encounter in the future some variation of that type of threatening situation. But if your environment doesn't show you any cues that anything like that is going to happen, then those dreams gradually, like, okay, you have now rehearsed for that, but there is nothing that shows that anything like that will happen, so you don't need to dream about that right now. But if something reminds you of that very strongly, then the dreams come up again. And this is what many people with recurrent nightmares that and post-traumatic dreams say, that if something reminds them of the original event, then the nightmares come immediately back. As if they would need to prepare again. The brain has detected, hey, there is a potential threat coming, let's get ready if it comes.
You're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is why we dream, and I'm playing you an interview that Finnish psychologist Antti Revonsuo had with Shrinkwrap's David Van Noyes, a fellow psychologist, who asked Revonsuo whether he considered that the more prehistoric threat from wild animals in the wilderness could translate in our modern minds into, say, the threat we felt from a boss or even someone exhibiting symptoms of some prehistoric thing we feared.
I think the system is flexible, but it seems to come with kind of like default settings. Because if we look at children's nightmares and bad dreams, they are full of these universal being chased by a monster type of dreams. And they are very sensitive. Children are very sensitive to that type of stimuli as well. And if we think about how children grew up maybe in a hunter-gatherer environment, that they were observing wild animals and dangerous animals in nature all throughout their childhood and learning which ones are dangerous and in what way they are dangerous. So very naturally, they were probably also dreaming about animals. We know that also children still dream much more about animals than adults do, that the percentage of animal characters goes down as children grow up. And children are also very sensitive in taking in from the media various characters that look a little bit like monsters or are somehow frightening. Like here in Finland, for example, we have a cartoon going in the TV, famous here, called Moomin cartoons. And there is one kind of strange character, which is called some kind of a ghost that's going just around in the forest. It doesn't hurt anyone, but it looks scary. And in one study where they had interviewed lots of children here, it came out that this character was the leading character in their bad dreams. So children are very sensitive to picking up what is the potential monster or the potential predator in the environment. And then you start to have dreams where that character is going to chase you and attack you in your nightmares.
Maybe that was why we created lullabies, to proactively banish those nightmares for our children and give them sweet dreams instead.
Dream away, child, let your dreams run wild. Or a lifetime of worries could claim you. Dream away, child, let your dreams run wild. Or the years and the tears shed might tame you. For the last time we have tasted love's sweet tears by the fire's glow. If our hearts are strong, there'll be no long goodbyes when it's time to go. But the strongest hearts are sometimes broken, as the deepest vows aren't always spoken. And the greatest wounds we hide inside ourselves where they never show. So dream away, child, let your dreams run wild. For a lifetime of worries could claim you. Dream away, child, let your dreams run wild. For the years and the tears shed might tame you. When the winter weds the northern wind, the child they bury snow. And the branches bow like worried bridesmaids, but the trees will grow. Sun and earth in time will come together. God will give us back our summer weather. But the memories of that first sweet taste of love pass away so slow. Dream away, child, let your dreams run wild. For a lifetime of worries could claim you. Dream away, child, let your dreams run wild. For the years and the tears shed might tame you. Can the wise man count the pointless lies we tell of the price we pay? And are songs a place to keep those words of love that we could not say? When there's no room left to live inside ourselves, do we dream away?
Dreams and Why We Dream is the topic of my share in our tonight here on Lagunas KX935. Psychologist Antti Revonsuo has a theory that because The dream of them being chased, particularly by wild animals, seems to be so common in children, passed down from generation to generation, that there must be some evolutionary reason for it.
I've been thinking about how is it possible that children start to have these types of nightmares, which seem to be very stereotypical, that there is a monster or a wild beast or a bad guy chasing them and they are trying to escape. And this can happen at a very young age. So somehow, of course, I don't believe that it's possible to genetically encode a dream, but somehow there has to be some kind of readiness in the brain to be sensitive to this type of information. I mean, children love to play this kind of chase, like that you try to catch them and they run away and everybody's laughing. So this kind of chase is something they enjoy simulating also in the real world when they just play around. So it's very exciting for them. So I believe that it comes from interest in this sort of practicing how to get away from someone who is chasing you. And this must activate some sort of a general scheme or script. But can that be genetically coded? I don't know, but I'm very impressed how it can be so universal that so many people, and especially children, experience the very, very same or very highly similar dream. So it's the emotion. The emotion labels some of your experiences as potentially threatening, and then your memory and your dream production system takes those ingredients and somehow builds up this simulated threat around something that you felt fear towards in your waking life. And of course it makes sense that we should practice for those threats that actually are here in our real environment rather than the threats that were in the environment of hunter-gatherers. But since the result is some kind of a compromise, we have both these sorts of very ancient ancestral types of threats in our bad dreams and nightmares, and then we have very modern ones, especially when we grow up. And if we look at nightmares in adults, well, there is still this being chased and being attacked, a leading theme. But then we have these much more modern themes, like being late from a flight or being late from a lecture or an important exam, or you try to call and your phone is not working, or your computer crashes. I just last week had a dream where I was preparing a lecture or doing something with my laptop, and then it started to go really weird, and I tried to push control alt del. I tried to do everything to control it, and oh no, it's a virus. Now what will I do now? All my lectures are there, and how will I prepare? Can I still reboot it? And, you know, very, very modern threat, but also very real to me. Then when I was thinking about it, I was worried about having a virus or something, because the same laptop, it crashed a couple of times during the last few days, but then there was no problem. It just rebooted normally. But I remember I was thinking about, why is it doing something like this now? And then this came to my dream. And I remember even in the dream I was pushing control alt del and nothing happened. I was kind of amused at how accurate it can get with this kind of a very, very modern threat. But there was still this same fear as in any other nightmare.
Last night I had a dream, you were in it, and I was in it with you. And everyone that I know, and everyone that you know was in my dream. I saw a vampire, I saw a ghost, and everybody scared me. Scared me the most. Dream I had last night. Dream I had last night. Started out in the barnyard at sundown. Everyone was laughing. You were lying on the ground. You say, honey. Thank you.
I was in it with you. And everyone that I know, and everyone that you know was in my dream. Saw a vampire, I saw a ghost. Everybody scared me. You scared me the most. Dream I had last night, the dream I had last night in my dream.
You're listening to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5, talking about dreams tonight and why we dream. And you're listening to psychologist Antti Rivensuo in an interview he did with Shrink Wrap's David Van Noyes, where he tries to explain the evolutionary reason for us dreaming.
It's pretty common, actually, in many theories to think that dreaming has no function of its own, that it's just a side effect of some other kind of a process going on. At the moment, the most popular idea is that it's memory consolidation that is really happening in the brain, and somehow dreams are just side effects from that, sort of leaking out some experiences which don't make sense or don't have a function, but they reflect the function of memory consolidation, which we know that the brain is doing memory consolidation during sleep. But the relationship between dreaming and memory consolidation is still unclear. Many people believe that dreaming doesn't contribute to it. It's just reflecting that. But then some of the other principles is that we can see that dreams are specialized, that it's a world simulation, and this world simulation is specialized in simulating threatening events, that the most universal dream themes are these kinds of rather primitive threats like being chased, and they also reflect these sorts of ancestral themes. And then a further principle is that this threat simulation system is activated by encountering real threats in your real life. In clearest form, we see it in post-traumatic nightmares, where some real experience leaves a very powerful emotional memory, and then the post-traumatic nightmares are built around those emotional memories, and the repetition of this dream goes on and on with different variations. Also, this theory assumes that going through these kinds of threatening events in your dreams will make you more prepared to react and respond to similar events in your real life. This, of course, is pretty difficult to test empirically, this principle. Did the hunter-gatherers really become better at detecting, for example, predators in their environment, or better and faster in hiding from them or escaping from them because they were dreaming about being chased or attacked every night? Very likely. So this is, of course, difficult to test. And then one principle in the theory also refers to what we now in general know about our evolutionary history, that during most of human evolutionary history, we lived as hunter-gatherers in an environment which was pretty full of various types of threats from nature. It's different from our modern world, and that originally dreaming evolved to handle those types of threats and to simulate those types of threats. At least in that environment, dreaming would have had a function in the biological sense, which means that dreaming a lot about the threats in that environment made you a better survivor in your waking life. So it could have contributed to survival, and that's why dreaming stayed with us and evolved towards being a better and better threat simulator. And we know, for example, life expectancy was very short in those days. People lived on average 25 to 30 years only. So it means that the threat simulation system would have been most needed perhaps quite early in life. So we would expect that people have the strongest and most sensitive dream life, perhaps in their teenage years or early adulthood, because people died so young in that environment, partly because there were so many kinds of threats, that the threat simulation system would have had to be working with full steam to keep person alive until it was possible to have your own offspring. And I think this kind of evolutionary perspective was quite rarely considered in theories of the function of dreaming. So it gives a little bit different notion when we think about it in more biological terms. If we just look at the data that we have from dream research, dreams are far too well organized to be the products of purely random chaotic stimulation in the brain. If you accept that we can define dreaming as an organized world simulation, then we need to reject those theories that say it's a completely random process.
So, according to psychologist Antti Ravensuo, who you're listening to now, in an interview he did with his associate David Van Noyes, our dreams have purpose, and he has a theory for what that purpose might be.
When I came up with threat simulation theory, I realized that, well, nobody's going to take the theoretical idea seriously unless it's a testable theory. So I thought that this means that I probably need to develop a scale that defines a threatening event, a dangerous situation in a dream. And at this point, I recruited a student, Katja Valli. She was a psychology student at that time looking for a topic for her master's thesis, and offered this topic of developing a scale by which we could do exactly that, quantify how much threatening events occur in dreams and what is their more detailed content. And we made separate categories in this scoring system for identifying what is the source or the nature of the threat. Is it somebody being aggressive towards you, or is it some kind of natural catastrophe, or is it an accident kind of situation? Is it a disease or something like that? So we made a scale for the nature of the threat. Then who is being threatened? Is it the dream self? Is it some other familiar people in the dream? Are they strangers? Or is it not people, but it's just resources or valuables that are being threatened, or territory that is being threatened? So another scale, again, for the target of the threats. Then how does the dream self deal or respond to the threat? Are the responses or the actions and behaviors of the dream self reasonable? Are they something that, if this would be happening in real life, is the dream self doing something that would make sense as a real response, if we assume that this is a real situation? And already the first study showed that the threatening events in dreams are pretty frequent. About 2/3 of the dream reports contain some kind of threatening event, and about 20% of those events were more dangerous than we would expect, like these kinds of students that are studying here in a safe country would ever encounter in their real lives. Myself, I was surprised that when you really pay attention particularly to that category, that there is a lot of events in our dreams which are somehow threatening to someone in the dream. We defined threatening event. It is any event happening in the dream that, if that event would happen in real life, then somebody's well-being would be endangered, or some kind of resources, valuable resources or territory would be in danger to be destroyed or stolen or something like that.
We're talking about dreams here on KX935's The Sharon Hour tonight. Of course, there are always dangers, but in a relatively safe middle-class democratic society that's not at war, why would we have such a high proportion of, quote, threatening events in our dreams? You would think the high percentage would be weighted more towards people in the more war-torn zones, and maybe that percentage does go up.
Yeah, the theory says that this threat simulation system becomes more highly activated if the person lives in a real environment where threatening events are encountered and perceived in daily life, and more threatening events than what we usually encounter here in safe Western societies, but more akin to what life was like in the original evolutionary environment, which means that you encounter highly dangerous situations almost on a daily basis. But of course, it's difficult to find populations who live in this sort of an environment, but we then had the opportunity to collaborate with a dream researcher here in Finland who had already been collecting dreams in Iraq and in the Palestinian areas, and from children, especially children who had been exposed to warlike conditions, and then other children who had been living in more peaceful areas. So we had children's dreams reported from Palestinian children living in warlike zones or in peaceful zones, and then Kurdish children who were orphans, and part of them were very badly traumatized, others were not so badly traumatized. And then we had dreams from Finnish children living here in perfectly safe conditions. And the differences were very big between children living in completely safe environment here in Finland and children living in war zones or having encountered very much violence and all sorts of things. So the Finnish children, only in 30% of their dreams, we identified threatening events, whereas the most highly traumatized group of Kurdish children were orphans and had gone through most traumatic kind of life. 80% of their dreams contained threatening events. So almost all of their dreams, and also the nature of the threats that they dreamt about, situations that they had witnessed or heard about, was much more dangerous. So they were dreaming about threats to their physical safety and life. Dreaming and our waking consciousness are pretty much the same phenomenon, but our waking consciousness is like an online consciousness and dreaming consciousness is like an offline consciousness, world simulation. But it's the same phenomenon generated in the same way inside the brain. It's just how it is connected to the external world that is the difference. Our brain simulates a world also when we perceive the world, but it just uses the information that comes through our senses in wakefulness. In dreaming, it uses our memories.
It's so sad. You would hope that dreams would give relief rather than replaying all the worst things these children had to experience in real life. But it sort of bears out the theory that dreams prepare us for what's going on in real life, that maybe those memories are stored as practice fields for what we have to deal with. So maybe it's helpful. That anyway is psychologist Dr. Antti Revonsuo's theory, expressed here from an interview he did on a program called Shrink Wrap Radio, known for its psychology topics, and filched from here for the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935.
I'm not a clinician, but when I go around and I give lectures on dreaming, and sometimes people ask about horrible nightmares and why they have them, I've noticed that actually people find the explanation quite relieving when I tell them that, yeah, well, you know, your dreams, even if they feel horrible to have that kind of nightmares, but the original purpose really is to try to protect you. Because if it is a system that evolved, the purpose was to keep the person alive if that kind of horrible, threatening situations are faced in the real world. So it's just a sort of compulsory training session that your brain puts you through. It tries to make you a better survivor. And it's a stupid system. It doesn't understand that it was only a horror movie, or it doesn't understand that if you experience something terrible in the distant past, that this will never happen again. In that sense, it's a stupid system. It just looks into your emotional memory. It picks up your strongest negative emotions from there and the events that they were connected to. Then it recycles that into a threat scenario, and it puts you into the center, and you are the one usually who is being threatened. So even if you see a horror movie and they are completely fictional characters who are being threatened by fictional enemies, when you dream about it, it's you, and the enemies are somehow already part of your life, or you have been transported magically to the world of the horror movie. But all of the purpose of this system is originally to make you a better survivor. It's just like our immunity responses. They try to protect us from microbes. It doesn't feel nice when you have all the symptoms, if you get fever and whatever, but still trying to protect you. So it's the same with nightmares and bad dreams, that they are for your protection even if they feel horrible. Just take them as compulsory rehearsal training sessions that have been pre-programmed into your brain. Of course, this theory also got a lot of criticism, like any theory would. And one of the major criticisms was that, yeah, well, even if this theory would somehow be plausible in the case of bad dreams and nightmares and recurrent dreams, there is still a very large proportion of dreams which are neutral or positive. So how do we explain those dreams? Well, I just didn't have an explanation for them. I just used to be thinking that either they don't have any function at all or they must have an independent function. And now recently I have been given more thought about what could be a function that is independent of threat simulation but would still be also some kind of simulation function. And the most plausible theory there or theoretical idea would be that positive dreams and neutral dreams might be simulating social interactions, social skills, and strengthening our social bonds. And last year, together with my colleagues, we formulated this into what we call the social simulation theory, dreaming. Some other people have already previously talked about the possibility that dreams could be social simulations, but nobody has really formulated this in a very strict manner as a real testable theory. So this is what me and my colleagues have been doing recently, and now we are, in a way, planning to do exactly like we did previously with the threat simulation theory, that now we want to make some clear predictions and tests of the social contents of dreams, social interactions in dreams. Are they such that they could serve a function as that kind of a theory would predict?
And here's where lucid dreams can be very helpful. Dreams, how and why we dream, is the topic on my KX 935's The Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James. And I'm going to play you now a little bit of a TED talk by a lucid dreamer, somebody who's taught themselves to do it, Charlie Morley.
A lucid dream is a dream in which you know you're dreaming as you're dreaming. Scientifically speaking, it is a hybrid state of consciousness. And although it's only been a scientifically verified phenomenon for the past 30 years, within Tibetan Buddhism, it's been a verified mind training method for over 1,000. A fully lucid dream can be so hyper-realistic that many people believe they've entered another dimension of reality. In fact, they have. But that dimension is not out there somewhere. It's in here. Once you know you're dreaming, there's a whole range of psychotherapeutic benefits you can choose to carry out. But one of the most powerful, and one of my favorites, is that within the lucid dream, you can intentionally engage the source of your nightmares. I taught myself how to lucid dream at 16 years old. And although my lucid dreams had occasionally presented me with nightmarish aspects, it wasn't until much later that I discovered the true potential of how lucid dreaming can transform these nightmares into spiritual and psychological growth. Because to face both our personal and collective cultural nightmares with lucid awareness can be an amazing route towards self-discovery, insight, and healing. I was actually making my living as a hip-hop rapper working with disadvantaged kids. So as you can imagine, going from that to the world of lucid dreaming came as quite a surprise. And in response to that surprise, I found that I became quite serious and kind of puritanical with my own lucid dreaming practice. I tried to banish any and all dark or nightmarish aspects from my lucid dreams. But of course, any attempt to sanitize or to control your dreams only represses the material. And so the more I tried, the more these nightmarish elements would reappear. So in the end, I went to see one of my Buddhist teachers about this. I sat him down and I told him all about this. He waited till I was done and then he gave me the kind of look that only really your mum or your meditation teacher would ever give you. He says, "I advise you to do precisely the opposite of what you have been doing. These nightmarish elements you refer to may well be shadow aspects. You must embrace the shadow. You must integrate the shadow." Right, I thought, but what is the shadow? And how do we integrate it?
Well, listener, for that you're going to have to listen to my future Sharon Hour coming up Monday nights at 9 on Laguna's KX 935, where I'm going to delve into the shadow inspired by Jung's psychoanalytical theory about the dark undersides of our personality and the various forms that might take compared with the side of us that we're more comfortable presenting to the world. However, that'll have to do it in the main for this week's show, which will rebroadcast on iTunes or on our own dedicated podcast. You just have to go to kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. I do want to mention that if you're listening live, there's the advantage that this station does broadcast emergency alerts. So even if you have Alert OC or Nixie on your phone, our radio airwaves sometimes work better than your cell in certain areas. But I mainly want to use this end of show to give you a preview of a band we have coming up on December the 8th here in Laguna Beach. It segues from this show because it's a song by Nancy Wilson of Heart, who is the headliner at our upcoming concert, tickets for which are available on our website, kx935.com. The title of the song is, appropriately for this show, These Dreams. Listen to it here, then go listen to it live in just a few days. Meantime, I'm Sharon James, wishing you a great week ahead.
Freedom is a kiss, but the freedom.